welcome to this week's episode of the Green for Health podcast with Angela Hayes.
Hi, and welcome to Green for Health, where today I'm joined by Rob Shooter. Rob is a radiotherapy physicist at the Christie Hospital in Manchester and an honorary lecturer at University of Manchester. He's a founder and the chair of the Institute of Physics and Engineering in Medicine Environmental Sustainability Group. Wow, that's a mouthful. Have I got that right,
well,
Rob?
Yeah, well done.
Phew, glad that's over. Welcome, thanks very much for joining me today.
No problem.
So, Rob and I, we met through our sustainability group at the Christie Hospital. And I've been really impressed by all the stuff that you've done, Rob. You've done stacks. Do you want to, are you able to briefly summarise some of the green stuff you do? Like, bearing in mind, we've only got 40 minutes or so.
I can talk for a while. So the stuff we're doing, that's, set up a sustainability group in IFM in February 2020, just before the world went crazy. And that was basically because I've been doing lots of green stuff personally, but then I felt like I kind of needed to transition to the kind of making changes at work as well. But it felt kind of quite lonely. It felt quite like kind of like you're up against it yourself. So by creating this group, other people were telling me what they were doing, and you kind of, you can almost, it made this kind of network and made it felt more friendly and made it feel more warm and less lonely.
Yeah.
So that was quite nice. And through that, we've done quite a lot of things. We've had quite a lot of articles published in kind of journals and in Scope, which is the magazine for Institute of Physics and Engineering Medicine. We've had lots and lots of talks at different conferences. I've been invited to talk in Belgium now as well recently, which is quite nice.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not going there, obviously.
Getting over to Belgium then.
Yeah, exactly. I would do it by Eurostar, but I'm going to do it on online instead because they said you could do that. And that sounds like a better option, especially with kids as well.
Yeah.
So quite a lot of those things. I've also started doing carbon footprinting projects. So like a basic way of like working out what's the kind of the amount of greenhouse gases produced by a certain kind of process. So we looked at radiotherapy and we've kind of got the results of that now, but we're trying to make that a much bigger thing, multi-center thing, by applying to NIHR, which is the National Institute of Healthcare Research. To try and make that even bigger.
Wow.
We're also in the process of making, hopefully, so kind of I'm a physicist, so I've kind of got, we've got the group there, but the idea is to make kind of a joint group with the clinicians and radiotherapy, radiotherapists, kind of within oncology, so we can kind of get like kind of a multidisciplinary group doing it. And Estro have started kind of putting together kind of a green task force, which hopefully I'll be involved in, so that kind of we can kind of make it bigger and bigger and bigger. It's amazing how much has happened in 2 years.
It's I don't know about you, I only spend a day and a half a week doing sustainability, and it could occupy me as a full-time person easily.
It's going out of me as well, really. I need to be aware that it's not my main job. Well, it's not my job really, I'm not employed to do it in any way, shape or form.
Do you not have any funding in your role then to do? Is it all just kind of squeezed in amongst your other commitments?
No, squeezed in amongst other stuff. I'm lucky because I'm kind of a researcher, so I'm kind of more in charge of my own time.
Okay.
But so that's how I can kind of squeeze it in. But it also means I'm squeezed by other stuff as well. So, yeah.
But
it's important and it's interesting, so it needs to be done.
Absolutely. It doesn't feel like work to me. I don't know about you. It feels...
No, sometimes I almost feel guilty. Like when I kind of get asked to talk about it at stuff, I almost feel like I'm talking about my hobby. Like, you know, lots of people, you know, some people would talk about football the way I talk about climate change sort of thing.
Do you feel when you're talking about stuff about this, do you feel people's eyes rolling like, oh God, he's on his soapbox again?
Or not him again? Yeah, pretty much. Yeah,
shut him up.
My friends are well fed up of it. But interestingly, over time, they kind of, I think it does sink in. I've got quite a few friends that have turned vegetarian over time after hearing me ramble on. A lot of them, yay, anytime they. Like every time they kind of fly somewhere, then I'll go, yeah, I know, Rob, I'm sorry. and just and stuff like that. So they are becoming more and more aware. And I've got another friend who now can't buy anything from Amazon because of that reason. So I don't know.
Because they can hear you, big.
They can just hear me nagging at them.
That was right, me. So my husband, he's an anaesthetist at Salford Royal, and he goes to a conference over in Dingle, and he has done this. It's based over in Dingle. He goes over there most years for this conference, and then he announced that the conference was on again after it had been off for with COVID. It was happening again, and I kind of looked at him and just said, well, good luck telling the kids that you're going to be flying to Dingle when we've said we can't be flying on abroad holidays. You know, good luck telling them that. So he ended up doing it through public transport. So he went. Admittedly, I gave him a lift to Stockport train station, but I waved him off at Stockport train station, and then he made his way over to Dingle in Ireland. So,
wow, impressive.
Yeah, it was pretty good. You know, it took him a lot longer, but I think he really enjoyed it in the end. And so yeah, it can be done.
Because I'm planning on going, because basically Estro this year is in Vienna, and I'm planning on going there by train. I'd organised that for Estonia in 2020, but of course in the end it was all online because of COVID. So hopefully we can go there by train, but that takes like 22 hours or something. So you can do the night train, which I think could make it quite nice, but it's a long one.
Yeah.
But Vienna's quite a long way away, to be fair.
Yeah, I think it took him a good 24 hours, I think, of solid travel to get to Dingle, and that's not that far away.
No, exactly. But it has got a lot of sea in between, which doesn't help.
It has.
The handy thing about the UK to mainland Europe is there's the Eurostar, so you can get under that bit quite quickly.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. Okay, so what got you started on the green stuff right from the start then? Can you cast your mind back to?
Well, I kind of. I suppose it started when I became a bird watcher. I'm a real geek, right? A physicist and a bird watcher.
I say nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. I was about kind of like 12 or something like that. And my interest in the environment just kind of expanded massively from that point onwards. And I went to university. I kind of joined a conservation volunteers group there. And just, I don't know, it just carried on and on. And then became vegetarian like 11 years ago, and it's just carried on progressing, and always kind of been very aware of it. And then recently, having had kids, it's made me kind of even more hell-bent on sorting it out, because the world they're going to grow up in is terrifying to try and imagine. Like, what we see around us now, on the kind of the extreme weather we're getting, is with 1.2 degrees of warming, depending on what we as a humanity decide to do, we could even be heading for like 3 or 4 degrees. That is unimaginable what that's going to look like. And we could easily be at like 2 degrees by the time my kids are in their like kind of like 30s 40s. And I can't imagine what it's going to look like. And I want to try and you protect your kids as much as possible. But yeah, a lot of people have a blind spot about kind of climate change. They'll kind of buy the kind of safest car seat, whatever, and be really worried about that. But then they'll ignore climate change, which is much more of a kind of a threat to everyone. And it's that kind of really has kind of driven me on recently.
Yeah.
That was pretty much about as summarized as I can get.
I think what I heard it on the news, I think, in the last few days, because there's been a lot more coverage, hasn't there, about climate crisis, particularly with the COP27 stuff. And I think one of the news reporters was saying about this keep 1.5 alive. And then I think there's, like you say, now the threat is that actually that's unrealistic and we're not going to achieve 1.5. But what he was saying was that it's a bit of an arbitrary figure. What does that mean? I think to most people, it's a bit like, well, what is the big deal? It'd be quite nice for it to be maybe a little bit warmer. I don't think there's that understanding about the
effects of that. I saw a really nice infographic about that the other day. And like, it kind of like, like sea level rise 1.5 degrees means like 40 centimeters of sea rise, 2 degrees means like 60 centimeters sea level rise, 3 degrees means a couple of meters, and then 4 degrees means like 9 meters of sea level rise. And there's kind of all the differences it makes to kind of food production. And at 2 degrees, basically, it kind of makes most or quite a lot of farmland impossible to farm. And by 4 degrees, it basically means there's like huge, huge kind of global food shortages. And that's when it can start feeling a bit more at home. So there's definitely things out there that make it feel more real. Yeah. Because it doesn't feel like 2 degrees means that much here. That, you know, that if it's slightly warmer here by 2 degrees, it won't make much difference. But it does to the poles, and it does to when you're kind of trying to farm, and it does to the weather. It makes a huge difference to weather. Even a couple of degrees makes a big difference to the amount of moisture that goes into the air. So you get a lot more rain, and you get more flooding, and you also get there's lots of kind of positive feedback loops. So if the kind of the poles start. Or the kind of permafrost starts melting at the poles, you get a release of methane, and that's a very, you know, 25 times more effective at global warming than carbon dioxide is. So that means you just get multiplication of the problem. So then it kind of gets hotter, so then it releases more methane, it gets hotter again, and you just go around in circles. So you can easily kind of get a runaway with it all, and that's what's probably the most terrifying thing of all of it, is we're starting to see some of those tipping points, really.
Yeah. I think I do. I present at various different places, and I always use my own team to practice on. And one of the slides I have that they were quite shocked by when I put it on was that. So we're trying to keep this 1.5 degree alive, this 1.5 alive, try and cap it that. But if we see global temperatures go between 2 and 3 degrees, then I think the figures are something like 99% of Cyprus will be desert like. And similar kind of figures will affect Spain. So all of these areas that we use for either housing or for farming.
The Met Office.
Where's all this going to happen if these places are uninhabitable? And and the other thing about the sea level rises is that it's not just kind of one or two houses along the coastline, like the whole of London is under threat, isn't it? So where do these people live then if their homes are no longer?
Yeah, and like Bangladesh is like really like stuck with this, because like even 40 centimetres is going to be critical to them, and lots of the island in the Pacific as well. So it you know, does cause problems. And then you're kind of going to get lots of kind of climate refugees, right?
Yes.
Increasingly so. And then, you know, what problems does that cause? So
it's quite worrying, isn't it? Definitely. So anyway, we're going to try and lift it a little bit now.
Good luck with that.
If we can. So but kind of on a serious note, do you find that this stuff gets you down? Do you ever lose hope with it, or what kind of keeps you? I mean, you're smiling away there and we're kind of like laughing away, but actually I feel that I could quite happily, you know, seek proper help on this. If I let myself, I find that it can be all consuming. I never take I was saying today on a conference that I was on, it's almost like I'm wearing sustainability goggles all the time. It's like they're constantly on. I can't ever remove them, and every single decision that I make has got, I can't help it now. It makes me
I completely agree. A book I mentioned before, How Bad Are Bananas by Mike Berners-Lee, is the sort of book that really made me see the carbon footprint of everything.
Right.
And once you've read that, you can't forget it. So every decision you make is like kind of got that goggles on, like you said. But it used to make me feel quite anxious, all of this stuff. But since doing something about it, or at least kind of feel like I'm doing something about it, it's made me feel less anxious, because at least, you know, when my kids in like 30 years time ask, like, what did you do about this, Dad? Look at the police. I can at least say, I tried, this is what I did, sort of thing. I think there's general, a growing thing about kind of climate anxiety.
Definitely, yeah. My daughter listened to the last podcast I did, and she said you should do something about anxiety and the environment, because I definitely think that there will be people that will struggle with that. And you know, she's an 18-year-old who can pick up on that, and so I have to almost rein in some of my concerns that I'm not projecting that on. I feel bad enough, and I'm conscious that I want to make them make the right choices, but also have to kind of carry out my role as, you know, a responsible parent by not terrifying the living daylights out of them.
Exactly. Yeah. My eldest is only 4, so it's he probably doesn't get most of it at the moment.
He's got it all to come.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Have you got a big folder ready to just kind of sit down, son?
A slide deck to give to him at some point. No, but I do worry we're kind of like really kind of biasing his view on stuff and kind of, I don't know, making him anxious about stuff, because he already goes, like, whenever we walk somewhere and he sees a bit of litter, he picks it up and puts it in the bin. It's like, it's bad for the planet and stuff like that. And he gets fed up with cars as well quite regularly, because we're always moaning about cars constantly. So anytime they're on the pavement, he's like, oh, they're not supposed to be there, they shouldn't be doing that. Which is fine as long as the driver isn't standing next to the car, which sometimes they are.
Oh, no, I think that's good that if the driver's there. I don't know if I've told you this story already, but I tapped on the window of a police car who'd got his engine idling just outside the hospital. So outside a cancer hospital, he's got his engine chugging along with all these pollutants going into the environment. And so I tapped on the window of his car, and he'd arrested somebody who was sat in the back who was watching this kind of this scenario, this drama unfolding. And I was like, are you all right turning your engine off, because it's really bad for the environment? And he went, I can't, I've got to leave it on because of the radio. So I said, well, that's rubbish, that, isn't it? You need to, you know. And I didn't leave it there. I went and emailed his superintendent, but I got a reply, so I was quite pleased. But my kids are always, oh, please don't say anything, please don't say anything, just walk on. So I think if your son has said this kind of stuff within earshot of this person, I think bring it on, because it's harder to ignore kids. They're not as preachy as adults, or as me. I know I'm dead annoying and always embarrass my kids and husband, yeah, all the time.
Yeah, I feel really sorry for my kids in the future.
So you've talked a bit there about your kids. So in your your wider family, are they as into the environment as you are then?
No, not at all. my parents are currently in Malta, having flown there, of course. I don't think it particularly crosses their mind that much. I think they're kind of aware climate change exists, but I don't think they think it's anything they have to do anything about. I think there's almost like this kind of new version of climate denial, which is where everyone accepts that climate change exists now, but they deny they have to do anything about it. Whereas that's not true. Like, kind of, if everyone did something about it, it would make a huge difference. If everyone kind of ate meat only once a week, or flew less and holidayed more locally, it would make a colossal difference.
Yeah.
I think they don't necessarily acknowledge some of the changes that are already happening. Like, kind of, if you know, whenever it's kind of too hot in the summer, and say this is just another sign of climate change, they're like, no, it's just a bit hot. It's like, it's not weather, this is climate change. And it's kind of hard to get that across. I'm kind of probably the anomaly, maybe even black sheep of the family with the climate change obsession.
You're out of the will, are you, because of it?
Hopefully not. I'll take him out, we'll just give it to Greenpeace or something.
Yeah, we didn't give you your share, we thought you'd rather give it to Greenpeace, Rob. Is that all right? And you're going, oh. So I believe you successfully won an award for the green stuff that you've done in the hospital.
We kind of got given some money from the Northwest Green NHS to do the radiotherapy comfort pudding project. Yeah. So we got that pretty much this time last year, and it was only a 6-month thing, less than 6 months, so we did it by April. But that sort of carried on and being developed a bit further.
What was that all about? Can you?
So we wanted to find out what the carbon footprint of radiotherapy was, because if you kind of know kind of the hot spots of it, so where the bits of radiotherapy that kind of produce the most carbon footprint are, you can then look at those and try and reduce that carbon footprint. It turns out that about 70-80% of the carbon footprint of radiotherapy was from patient travel to and from the centre. So there's a couple of things that that kind of makes you think of, is like, one, could patient public transport be used more often? But from kind of chatting to patients, we did a patient focus group, it turns out that's kind of probably unlikely, because buses and trams don't have toilets. And quite a lot of the patients we spoke to were now having kind of side effects from radiotherapy, needed access to a toilet, or kind of needed the kind of the ride to be quite smooth because like kind of pain and stuff like that. So public transport, unless you happen to be in London, so like Guy's and St Thomas, I think about 60% of their patients travel by public transport because they're next to London Bridge, and a train has a toilet, and that seems to be kind of part of that process.
How many percent? Sorry,
60.
60. Oh, right. I was going to say, right. Okay.
So, and whereas the kind of the question, it's probably, I think it's like more like 25%. It's kind of quite a lot lower.
Okay.
But still something. And it also, we're not quite sure whether that's at the start or whether that's halfway through or at the end. People might switch back to car because, you know, when side effects get worse. The other thing is then there's hypofractionation, which is kind of where you have 5 visits to a hospital rather than say 20 or 30, and for the same outcome, same side effects, you can kind of have fewer visits, and that would reduce the kind of the transport burden quite a lot. So that's the other thing we're kind of looking into.
Brilliant, really interesting. So if you had, just to kind of my final question, if you were either to have a magic wand, or you were in a position, and the Minister for Health or the Environment, and you were able to kind of work your magic, what things would you do? What would you change, or what things would you do to make things move?
There's a French economist called Thomas Piketty who said the biggest thing you can do to kind of solve climate change is tax the super rich. So that'd be the first thing I'd do, because it's kind of, if you look at the carbon footprint of kind of like, you know, of kind of the richest, it's like, you know, tens, thousands of times bigger than kind of people that are just all right, well off. And they're hundreds of times bigger than the people that are kind of like the poorer people. So kind of making everyone's income more equal would solve a lot of it. And then you could use that taxation to build better public transport, kind of, yeah, you could then use that to kind of invest in green energy. I'd also try and find a way of stopping people flying so much, so like some sort of frequent flyer tax or something, or levy. It's gonna be hard to stop people kind of going on holiday, you know, once a year, and that's but then there's lots of people out there that fly regularly, and that seems unfair.
And it's also, yeah, that flights, certainly internal flights, well, anything actually, flights are usually a cheaper version of getting where you want to be.
Yeah, yeah. And so if, with that frequent flyer levy, it would kind of change that. It'd probably be complicated to put in, but, you know, I've got a magic wand, so it's fine.
Absolutely. You can do whatever you like. Yeah. I like that idea. Yes, then. That's, yeah, I like that a lot. It would bring about, it's very kind of a very social way on many fronts, that idea, Rob. So I like that. So going forward, sorry, I said that was my last question, but I've just got another one, if you don't
mind.
No. Sorry, I'm turning the computer off. What things have you got in the pipeline? What stuff are you working on, or that you're hoping to start doing?
So more carbon footprint stuff. It's since reading that book that I constantly bang on about. Carbon footprinting has become that thing that I really want to do. So also trying to look at PET imaging and brachytherapy. I think the more we can understand the carbon footprint of the different bits of kind of cancer treatment, the more we can work out the kind of lowest carbon way of doing cancer treatments, or kind of release radiotherapy cancer treatments. I'd really like to kind of do more with estro. And I'd also really like to try and encourage as many people as possible to kind of take the train to estro next year, because that's something that I can kind of do without being, something I can do as external to estro rather than having to be part of it.
Okay.
But that's the things I can think of now. Hopefully more things.
There'll be definitely more. And what's about kind of doing something within, that's another question I've got. Like, I'm really not sticking to what I'm saying, but is it something that you would like to do seriously within your job role? You kind of said at the beginning that you do all of this stuff and it's not your job. Is that something that you would like to do, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. That's part of the reason why I mentioned, like, I'm applying to an NIHR fund. If I did get that, that would give me 50% of my time to do carbon footprinting stuff. So that's part of the reason why I'm doing that, because it is becoming a kind of reasonable fraction of my job, but yeah, it's not what I'm paid to do. So it would be nice to have, you know, that acknowledged and some money to kind of back that up, sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
But because we'll see. It's up to them now.
Yeah, we talked this again on this conference this morning that lots of people that were very engaged and could see the link between climate change and public health, wanting to do things, not sure about the best ways to do it, but very much talked about the conflict within their working lives, that the priority isn't to do the climate change stuff, even if they've got this passion and drive to do it. It's other things seem to take priority and trump the work that you might want to do with the environment. So I think,
and that can make you more frustrated and more anxious as well, right? Because you kind of, I'd like to do that, I'm just not getting the time to do it. And
And I think it's got to be everybody's role. It's not just got to be a job for some guy down in estates putting in low energy light bulbs.
Exactly. It needs to be kind of absolutely integral to everything everyone does.
Yeah,
that's the only way we've got any chance of getting near 1.5 degrees.
Absolutely.
We need to do it now as well.
We needed to. I mean, I say that I'm late to the party. I kind of feel like if you were interested in this when you were 12, then you've been doing it a lot longer than me. But I feel very much late to the party, and think there were people that were warning us about this, you know, in the 80s, weren't there? And we don't have time to faff about any longer, do we?
It's depressing when you start looking how far back some people were talking about this. It's like, well, this has been going a while. But it's like that with every kind of, like, you know, social change, or kind of, you need to kind of get to a social tipping point when suddenly it becomes accepted and right, we're doing something about it, right? So it will happen. It's just, it should have already happened.
Yeah, I think there's a slide that I hope you don't mind, but I've pinched that you did, which was about COVID, and you've got this slide where you say if climate change was happening at the rate that COVID happened, we'd be turning our lives upside down to deal with it. And I think it's really powerful, that slide. So I'm kind of confessing to you that I've pinched it, because it was so powerful. It was something that when I looked at it, it made me go all cold, you know, like, God, yeah, it's really true. So
nice to make my words make everyone go cold.
yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, that's brilliant. Thanks ever so much for giving up your precious time, Rob, to chat to me. I've found it really interesting. It's been really lovely talking to you. So thank you very much.
Cool, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Green for Health. Thank you again. See you next time.